We are still in the midst of John 4, and that's where we're going to stay this morning. I want to conclude the account of the woman of Samaria, and then we might possibly get into the official son this morning. But we had kind of ended last class at the tail end of this account and didn't really get the wrap-up on it, or at least the first half of it. So I want to do that and then let that push us forward into the next part. Because this is really the Samaritan woman's moment. This is where she gets it. She's there. She's at the place where Jesus has guided her to be. And so then we're going to see some direct results and implications of that. And they are positive things. These first few accounts in John where Jesus is interacting with folks are generally positive accounts. We see people that react positively to Jesus, with the possible exception of the Pharisees and John's disciples, because they don't really understand yet. But then again, even when some of those do understand, they still reject Jesus. But for the most part, in Nicodemus's account, in the Samaritan woman's case, in the case of the official in Cana, these are all very positive stories because they have positive results. The plan is working. We're about to get to a section, though, where controversy comes on the scene, where people are not as accepting of Jesus and his message, whereas these first accounts believed, the others either struggle to believe or refuse to believe. So let's finish the account of the Samaritan woman. We're going to pick up in verse 21 this morning of John 4. And Jesus, speaking to the woman, if you recall in verse 19 and 20, she says, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain." She's pointing to Mount Gerizim. "Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, yet you Jews say that the place to worship is in Jerusalem." And if you recall, this is directly after Jesus has told her about her conduct and about her life, that she's been married 5 times, the man she's with now is not her husband. So it almost seems like she changes the subject. She switches the focus off of herself and on to a more generic subject, that where the Samaritans would differ from the Jews. So there was a temple, a Samaritan temple on Mount Gerizim at one point. It does not exist at the point that they're having this conversation, but about 100 years prior, there was a temple on Mount Gerizim that the priests of Samaria had erected for worship there. Very similar to the way that Jeroboam erects temples outside of Jerusalem when he comes onto the scene back when in the divided kingdom. So they are using this temple as a means of worship, but it's a mixed bag. It's a complete shamble of religion. They're trying to mix pagan practices with worship of God, and they're just intermingling ideas, and they've completely got things wrong. Now, during the period of silence, the Maccabees, John Hyrcanus, comes along, and he invades Samaria with the Jews of those days, and they destroy this temple. So it is wiped out. It's no longer there. But obviously, from what this woman says, it's still a revered site. Now, we talked about this a little bit last class. Why do you think Mount Gerizim would be the place for this temple? There were two mountains right there outside of Shechem, Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. What significance do these have? Okay, that's where the blessings and cursings were given back in Deuteronomy as Moses is guiding the people towards the promised land as they're about to go into the promised land. The blessings and the cursings happen at Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. And Mount Gerizim would have been the mountain of the pronouncing of the blessings. And so it's revered as kind of a holy site, obviously. And then Shechem, obviously, is the area that she talks about that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. And there's a lot of history associated with that area as well. So she says that our fathers worshipped on this mountain, yet you Jews say that the place to worship is in Jerusalem. And there's an obvious question that's implied there. Which one is correct? What do you say? And Jesus completely defies, I would think, her expectations by saying, neither one. Neither one. He says, believe me, woman, an hour is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. And so he's talking about this future event that is coming, in which both of these places are going to be, the significance for worship on both of these places is going to be negated. And again, we talked about this a little bit last time, but the idea there that Jesus is saying is not that neither of these places are acceptable for worship. His point is every place is going to be acceptable for worship. And all people are going to be accepted as worshipers. And he's going to expand on that idea as we continue on and the Samaritans come as a result of this woman's testimony. But again, we went back to places like Zechariah 14 last time that talked about that God would give living water from the east to the west. And the idea there is to the whole world, all-encompassing. But again, as far as Samaritan worship is concerned, it's a mixed practice. And although the Jews didn't get their worship of God right, they at least worshiped the one true God. So when he says, you Samaritans worship what you do not know, we worship what we do know, we being the Jews. We worship what we do know because salvation is from the Jews. Now, in what two major ways would that statement be correct? How is salvation from the Jews? What do you think he means? What's that? Okay, so one major way, Jesus' lineage, Jesus' physical form comes through the lineage of the Jews. What about the other way? Through the law. Okay, so the law was given to whom? It was given to the Hebrews. Hebrews, Jews, same folks. And so then it was meant to be passed down and carried out through that people, the people that God chose. And then they were supposed to be a priesthood to the nations, to use the imagery that God uses in Exodus. And so then the law had been given to the Jews so that God's path to salvation could be preserved by his providential power through them. But it was never meant to be only for them. Never meant to be. They were to be the means of carrying it out. And they were to be the means by which nations came to the law and conformed to it. But it was never meant to be only for them. And I think that's a point that really needs to be brought out, not only to the Samaritan woman, but also to the Jews. And Jesus will definitely make that point. But again, also, Jesus Christ comes through the Jews. So that's definitely a way in which salvation literally comes from the Jews. But then his continuation of that statement. An hour is coming, verse 23. An hour is coming, and now is, or is now here, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. What's the implication of that statement? If there are true worshipers, what also are there? There's false worshipers. There's untrue worshipers. Worshipers that don't have any idea. Yes. Okay, so the first one was a covenant, and this one is also a covenant. Yes. But then the way that this sentence is structured is meant to reference the previous statement in 4:21. and to underline the immediacy of the need for the believers who participate in true spiritual worship. If you are going to participate in true worship of God, you have got to know whom it is that you are worshiping. And that's what the Samaritans have gotten wrong. They don't understand God because they have not been in God's law to understand Him. Now, part of that is they haven't had a teacher like Jesus. I mean, there is that. Not that I'm saying they're without fault, but they don't truly know God. And remember, that's one of John's big ideas, is to come to know God. And that really comes up through this whole chapter. Again, if you go and circle that word know, you'll have circles all over your Bible in John. So Jesus reaffirms then the main emphasis of this discourse. The only true worship is spiritual worship. Okay, so if there's a spiritual worship, again, what's the other side of that coin? What other kind of worships are out there? Pagan worship. There's a non-spiritual worship. And that doesn't even have to just be focused on pagan deities, does it? Is there a non-spiritual worship that had God as its focus? Or at least kind of as its masthead? Well, yeah. I mean, the Jews were practicing it right now, weren't they? So Jesus is saying then, the difference in worship here between true and non-true is not just a Jew-Samaritan worship. It's a worship between those who think spiritually, those who truly seek God, and those who do not. So inherent in this knowledge is not just an academic knowledge of what they know and what they don't know. It's what they have come to know, if that makes any sense. What they have come to understand. And if they don't have this understanding, they can't be true worshipers. I think to pull that forward, if we're going to take practical points from this, we need to be very focused on how we practice our religion, how we worship God. Is there a spiritual component to everything we do, both in the worship assembly and outside of it? Because all of it, in some regard, is worship. Yes? Yes. Because how we live our lives is a sacrifice to God, and sacrifice is a part of worship. So, Jesus says then, the Father wants such people to worship Him. Not people that have outward displays of piety or ritualism. God is spirit. So man's worship must mirror His nature. Man's worship must also be spiritual. Mark.
I'm not sure Jesus isn't making a play on Joshua.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And he says that they must worship God in sincerity and truth.
Yes.
So it's very much the same phrase that Jesus is using here. And so he may be appealing to the woman to if you're wanting to make a play on the fathers, mm-hmm. go all the way back.
Right.
It was disclosed in the bin, and the covenant was made at Shechem, which is just outside of where they are right now.
Right.
That there was a declaration early on.
Okay. That's a very good point. When Joshua does come to, does eventually bring the children of Israel back to the land, about to come into that, as Mark said, he makes that statement that they've got to worship in sincerity and truth. Same idea there. But Jesus kind of takes that idea to a new level and says that sincerity comes from the Spirit. So, very good point. Anyone else? Yes.
So what you have done, like you're talking, mm-hmm. is going to be evident out in the outside world.
Yes. Yes. So there is a component. We did just say that the outward displays of piety or ritualism are not true worship. But what he's just saying, if you couldn't hear that, is that there is a way in which those who worship in spirit will in some way display that type of worship to people that are looking. And that's what Jesus talked about, right? When he talks about letting your light so shine before men so that they can see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. There, if you are a truly spiritual person and you're living according to the way that God has called you to live, there is a way in which it cannot help but be seen in your life that the Spirit is present, that you are worshiping spiritually. So, very good point. Yes, it can. It can disqualify folks from... It is a big thing. It's a very big thing. As a matter of fact, it's one of the biggest things because it's a starting point. If we're not worshiping in spirit, then we definitely need to reevaluate from the very beginning where we are and then go back forth. There are consequences, yes. But again, this point that Jesus makes here in verse 24, God is spirit. If we're going to worship God, then it's got to be done in a way that mirrors God's nature. He is not just some physical being here. He's not some ambivalent force in heaven. Our worship needs to be a spiritual worship which mirrors His nature. But he also says, though, that spiritual worship can only be accomplished according to truth. There has to be a truth and a knowledge of that truth in play. And one can't exist without the other. That's the thing. If worship is not true, it's not spiritual. If worship is not spiritual, it's not true. But they both must be there together. So, again, this worship can't be according to any other source of revelation, as the Samaritans are claiming. God is truth. God is spirit, so man must worship according to his nature and according to his word. His word, because his word is an extension of his nature. And that's a big point with Jesus. Remember in Matthew, when he's talking about all authority has been given to me in heaven and in earth, it is because he is the living embodiment of God's word and will. And so our worship needs to conform to that will. And that's what Jesus is trying to do with the Samaritans here. Conform him there. Any other comments on that? These are great. Anything else on that? Yes, Mark.
I was thinking about certainly there's whatever is truth we learn from the Spirit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think there might be a way of thinking about this being worship in spirit, being in sincerity, that it is possible to be 100% totally committed and sincere and at the same time be in ignorance. That's what the Apostle Paul was mm-hmm. when he said that I've been in all kinds of good conscience mm-hmm. all of his life. The sincerity was there, but the truth was right.
Right. And who better than John to be writing a statement like this about being sincere but also needing the truth? I mean, James and John wanting to call down fire on people who didn't believe. The zeal, the sincerity is there, but they needed a better understanding. So even at this point, the disciples don't have the level of knowledge that they will yet have. So that's important to remember. And with John writing this in hindsight, you know, I'm sure that he's going back and looking at these things, much as Peter probably would have in his writings, and just seeing the ways that he wasn't there yet, even though he was farther ahead in his knowledge than the Samaritans were. Okay, so then verse 25 then, she continues, and she says, I know that Messiah is coming. And again, that word know. I know that Messiah is coming, who is called Christ. When he comes, he will explain everything to us. So this is probably an appeal back to what Jesus just said. You worship what you don't know. Now, she may have been feeling self-conscious or defensive. I don't know what her mindset is right there. But here's what she says. This is what I do know. And isn't it funny that the very thing that she says, I do know, is the very thing that is the basis of what Jesus is trying to get to. I mean, she jumps right to the heart of the matter. And so, here is what I do know. I know that Messiah is coming. And it's very interesting because we talked last time about the Samaritans. Where do they get their worship from? What do they hold as their authority as far as the scriptures are concerned? Primarily the first five books, Genesis through Deuteronomy. Okay, so they are disregarding the books of prophecy, the books of wisdom and poetry, all of those things they don't have in their library. The first five books, where does she get this concept of a Messiah from, is my question. Because where we see a whole lot of this is from places like Daniel, talking about the Son of Man that's coming. Isaiah, that talks about the suffering servant that's coming to redeem mankind. The minor prophets, again, we talked about Zechariah, we talked about Malachi, we talked about Joel. All these places where Jesus, this promised one, is mentioned as coming. Where is she getting this concept? I don't 100% no. It's possible she might be going back to places like Deuteronomy 15 through 19 that talks about this prophet that's coming after Moses. That may be one thing. But it's just interesting that this is what she zeroes in on. She has some knowledge of the Messiah. She doesn't have full knowledge yet, but she knows that someone's coming and she's looking for that person. She realizes that they're looking for that person. This is what she knows. And so then her statement can't set up Jesus more perfectly. And the thing is, he's guided her to this point. We can see that in the conversation. But the important part is, she got to this point. She's here. She is at the door and he's about to open it. And this is one of the first places in the Gospels that Jesus says, point blank, I'm the one you've been looking for. And so she says, I know that Messiah is coming, who is called Christ. When he comes, he will explain everything to us. And Jesus says to her, I am he. I am he who am speaking to you. And his response mirrors the manner in which God reveals himself to Israel, doesn't it? We talk about the I am statements in John. This isn't really considered one of them, but nonetheless, that's exactly what Jesus is doing. And it's the same verbiage, that ego ami in the Greek, I am. So Jesus is likening himself or associating himself directly with the God of Israel, the God that revealed himself to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, so on and so forth. Anything else on this section before we move on? Okay, verse 27 then. Picking up, just then his disciples arrived, and they were amazed that he was talking with a woman. Yet no one said, what do you want, or why are you talking with her? Then the woman left her water jar, went into town, and told the men, come, see a man who told me everything I ever did. Could this be the Messiah? They left the town and made their way to him. In the meantime, the disciples kept urging him, Rabbi, eat something. But he said, I have food to eat that you don't know about. And the disciples said to one another, could someone have brought him something to eat? My food is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work, Jesus told them. Don't you say there are still four more months, then comes the harvest? Listen to what I'm telling you. Open your eyes. and look at the fields, for they are ready for harvest. The reaper is already receiving pay and gathering fruit for eternal life, so the sower and the reaper can rejoice together. For in this case, the saying is true, one sows, another reaps. I sent you to reap what you didn't labor for. Others have labored, and you have benefited from their labor. Okay, so we're going to stop right there for just a moment. Okay, so remember, Jesus sent the disciples into town to go buy food and supplies. And now they're coming back at the tail end of this conversation. And they see Jesus sitting by this well with the Samaritan woman. Why would this have been strange? You didn't talk to a woman. You didn't talk to a Samaritan. Yeah. So again, we kind of said this last time. You got two things, two big things in play here. She's a woman and she's a Samaritan. Not only that, if we want to say there's kind of a third aspect of this, she's an immoral Samaritan woman because of her lifestyle. So it's probably known to these people who this woman is and what her reputation is. But his disciples arrive. They're amazed that he's teaching, talking with a woman. Yet, what do they do in their amazement? They don't say a word. They don't say a word about that woman and why he's talking to her. And that's to their credit. Their lack of reaction, I think, just goes to show that Jesus' disciples have gotten to a point where, despite their societal customs of rabbis not speaking to women or other concepts that they have, it shows the level of respect that they have for Jesus. Something different is happening here. Something important is happening. And so they trusted that Jesus must have had some good reason to speak with this woman. They don't know what it is, but he's got some purpose in mind. Jesus is not speaking with her in some sort of amorous sense or anything like that. They know that. So they wisely keep their mouths quiet. But we've reached the end of the conversation with Jesus and the Samaritan woman. So what does she do at the end of the conversation? She goes to tell the people. She goes to tell. What detail tells you about how she goes to tell the people? What's her mindset? Where's she at right now? She left behind the water pot. Why is that significant? They had to draw water, right? And that's what she went for. The whole point of coming to the well was to draw water that she needed. And remember, that's what she tells Jesus. Please give me this living water so I don't have to keep coming to this well over and over again. She needs water. But as Mark just said, her priorities have changed. And that is the big draw from this. No pun intended. Her priorities have changed. She has realized there's something more important here than this water that I need. I have to have it. And so when she goes with such alacrity, with such enthusiasm, that this water pot is completely forgotten. Now, can she go down to the local Walmart and just get a new one if that water pot's gone or broken while she's gone? No. I mean, this is an important thing. A vessel for drawing from this well is a necessity, and so it would have been very important. But to leave that pot behind shows that she's in a state of bewilderment. And so where does she go from there? She leaves the pot behind. She runs off. Where's she headed? She's headed back into the city. She's going back to Sychar to talk to the people, to tell them. So the pattern we've seen so far in John with the people who come to Jesus, and again, these stories have for the most part been positive thus far. The pattern we've seen in believers so far is for the person to speak with Jesus or have an initial experience with Jesus, and then they find out more about what Jesus has to say, and then immediately they go and do what? Tell someone else. Exactly right. They go tell someone else. I mean, you think back, for instance, about the four apostles that have been mentioned thus far. We have, I guess, five apostles, sorry. We have Andrew. We have Simon. We have Philip and Nathaniel. They are telling each other about this Jesus that they found and bringing each other to him to find out more about what he has to say. And so she goes into town. She goes to share this experience with others. What does she say to them? Come and see. Okay, let's focus on just those three words right there for a second. Come and see. When Jesus first meets his disciples in John, and he asks Andrew, "Why are you following me?" And he talks to Nathanael, and Nathanael says, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" What is it that he says to them? Come see. Come see. Okay? Now, fast forward, which I think is a fascinating thing. Fast forward to the end. When Mary Magdalene comes to the tomb, and she's outside the tomb, she doesn't know what's happening, then the disciples come to the tomb, all those things. They see the angel sitting there. What do the angels say? What's that? He's not in there, but what do they say? They said, come and see. Come and see. So this idea of believers actively coming to Jesus to see what it is. They are experiencing these things. Remember, in John writing to a primarily Greek audience in a Greek area, there's this big difference between the spiritual and the physical. And they need to experience this, and they need to see that these things are one in Jesus. And in so doing, they need to come to a knowledge and to a belief. And the way to do that is to come and see. This is an experience that they need to have. So the woman then goes to these people and she says, come and see a man who told me all I ever did. The come and see points directly back to Jesus. And again, if they have any knowledge of the woman's lifestyle, it's understandable that they would want to see the person that she's so excited about knowing the dark details of her life. I mean, would it have been an exciting thing for us to go to somebody and say, hey, come and talk to somebody who told me all the bad stuff I ever did? Please. Because I'd love for you to hear it firsthand. She's excited. And so their curiosity is piqued and they come. I saw this quote and I just thought that this was pretty interesting. Again, making practical application about this. The Christian life is based on the twin pillars of discovery and communication. No discovery is complete until the desire to share it fills our hearts. And we cannot communicate Christ to others until we have discovered Him for ourselves. First to find, then to tell, are the two great steps of the Christian life. So it's all well and good for us to come together here and to meet together as God's people and to worship and participate in worship with one another. But if we are not telling, if we are not going out and telling people, come and see, then we're only halfway there. And if we're only halfway there, we're not there at all. So, very important, this woman's experience. And again, her insistence that she found the Messiah is so convincing that the other people of the town came to Jesus. I mean, if this woman came into the door, you know, in a modern day context and said, I've seen Jesus, you know, we might be tempted to say, well, this woman's crazy. But something about what she says brings them out. And it's impressive that so many are willing to come listen to an unknown Jew in the midst of Samaritan territory on the basis of the testimony of this one immoral woman. I mean, this story just has so many details in it that if we glance over them and miss the importance of it, that you're just going to miss the point entirely. And so when Jesus is speaking with his disciples then, and they're having this conversation, in the meantime, the disciples kept urging him, Rabbi, eat something. There's no conversation about what did you say with this woman. There's no conversation about why is she taking off and bringing all these people out. Rabbi, eat something. And I mean, granted, Jesus was weary from his journey. We saw that from the very first part of this chapter. But their focus is on him and on his physical needs. And he says, I have food to eat that you don't know about. And I think he's almost saying, I just ate a huge meal. And there's more portions coming. You just wait. So we kind of have another conversation happening here, similar to the ones we've seen before with both Nicodemus and the Samaritan woman. There's an initial interaction with Jesus. The disciples say, have something to eat. Jesus gives an unclear statement or answer and says, I have food to eat of which you do not know. And interesting there how he says, you do not know, what he had just said to the Samaritan woman. Then there's a misunderstanding among the disciples. They're still thinking in physical terms, saying, is it possible that somebody brought him some food while we were gone? We just didn't know about it. Jesus gives another answer. My food is to do the will of him who sent me and to complete his work. And then he expands on that imagery by talking about the fields being ripe for harvest and that they are reapers. So again, same structure of the conversation happening here. Now, one of the consistent messages that Jesus tries to get across in his teaching all throughout the Gospels is that he came to accomplish the will of God. And this is the point that he's going to try to drive home to the disciples here. He came to accomplish the will of God. His glory is directly tied to the Father's glory. So their purpose is the same. So when he comes to do the Father's will, he is also accomplishing his own purpose. The uniqueness, though, of Jesus' earthly life is that he's the only human who can ever say that he was perfectly obedient to God's will. And it's in accomplishing this purpose that Jesus says, I am truly satisfied. I'm truly satisfied. And so then Jesus kind of pushing that point forward onto them. If you're accomplishing the Father's will, your purpose is fulfilled as well. Man whom I have made for my glory, Isaiah writes. My glory, God's glory. This is what we're created to do. Food is just the gas to get us to the destination, the physical body to the destination. So, and not that Jesus is telling them to neglect their physical needs or anything like that. He's not telling them never to eat again or anything like that. But he's saying, you need to wake up. As he's about to say here, open your eyes and see something. There's a spiritual concept in play here. And again, that's what he did with Nicodemus. That's what he did with the Samaritan woman. He used a physical example to make a spiritual point. And so just as the water that the Samaritan woman had come to draw would only temporarily quench her thirst, the food that the disciples brought is only going to temporarily satisfy hunger. Jesus points to the greater need. So then he gives this kind of saying. He says, don't you say that there are still 4 months till harvest? Now, this reference here is probably a Jewish proverb of some sort or saying. We would call it maybe a kind of a farmer's almanac kind of thing today. There were 6 divisions to the Jewish agricultural year. So there's seed time, there's winter, there is spring, and then there's harvest. So that's a 4-month gap there. And then there's summer and the season of extreme heat, which for us, we would say that that's kind of the same thing, right? There's summer and the season of extreme heat. So in any given year, it's going to take about 4 months for the seed that's spread in the time of harvest, or in the time of seed time, to grow into a crop worthy of harvest during that period. So what I'm guessing is, Sychar is an area, I'm not guessing this part, I know this part. Sychar is an area that is famous for its corn production. This is the Kansas of Palestine, if I want to put it in that way. Or maybe I should give it to Nebraska. This is the Midwest of Palestine. They grow lots of corn there. And this area would have been a place where they can consistently do that in each harvest time. This isn't the rocky area or the arid area around the Dead Sea. This is a fertile plain. And so it's possible then that Jesus is standing in a spot where he can look around and see fields of corn that are ready for reaping that are ready for harvest. And he says, look, look. Don't you say there are still 4 months, then comes the harvest. Listen to what I'm telling you. Open your eyes and look at the fields, for they are ready for harvest. But what's happening at this moment? Who's coming? Who's coming to Jesus? What's that? The people, the Samaritans from Sychar are coming. So Jesus then could say, look around at the harvest and see that it's ready. It's ready for harvest. It's ready for reaping. And then the Samaritans start coming into the valley. They start coming to Jesus. And Jesus can say, look, the harvest is ready. And you need to be ready. Open your eyes, because these fields are ready for harvest. The reaper is already receiving pay and gathering fruit for eternal life. Not physical life, eternal life. So the sower and reaper can rejoice together. So again, we got these people that are sowing in seed time. We got the people that are harvesting, and there's a 4 month difference there. Now, the Jews, to the Jewish farmer, sowing is a painful and laborious process. I mean, it is kind of still today, and we got machines and things, but to them, it's hard. They got to break the fallow ground. They got to spread the seed. They got to be sure the seed is taken care of and in a good place to make it through the winter. So it's a laborious time. Matter of fact, Psalm 136 talks about this. May those who sow in tears. But what's the latter half of that? May those who sow in tears reap with shouts of joy. Shouts of joy. He that goes forth weeping, bearing the seeds for sowing, shall come home with shouts of joy, bringing his sheaves with him. And so, I mean, this is a concept that's not unfamiliar. So, the harvest being a season for excitement because of the crop that's ready to be brought in, Amos speaks of a time when Jesus would come and he would bring both of these seasons together. They are back to back. There's no delay here. He says, behold, the days are coming when the plowman shall overtake the reaper and the treader of grapes, him who sows the seed. And so there's a point when the seed sower is going to be sowing more seed than the person can harvest, because the harvest is springing up so suddenly from the seed. And it's a time of great joy and abundance, Amos says. And so that's what's happening. Jesus has just immediately spread this seed, and it has been scattered then to the people of Sychar, and they are immediately harvesting the benefits of that. And that's Jesus' point. You need to be ready for this crop to be harvested, because they're coming. Get ready for them. And so it says then, 39 through 42, the result of this. Here's the harvest. Now many of the Samaritans in that town believed in him because of what the woman had said. Again, another reference to belief being the result of one hearing the testimony of another who's experienced Jesus. And so therefore, when the Samaritans came to him, they asked him to stay with them. The Samaritans are asking a Jewish man to come stay, most likely in their homes. Again, this is huge for them. Now, we kind of said last time, this conversation with the Samaritan woman, and especially Jesus bringing out the personal details of her life, is kind of a litmus test. Once he does this, what is going to be her reaction? Is she going to come to the light that's just exposed her sin for all to see? Or is she going to continue to go into darkness and regress back into her lifestyle? And I think she passes this test from all indications. And the Samaritans are passing this test too. They have heard about the light and they are coming to it. They are drawn to it, just as a plant would be drawn to the sun. And so this crazy concept, the people who are so despised by the Jews because they are defiled and corrupt and a mixed breed, are the very ones who have accepted Jesus before many of them have. I mean, this is big. And I don't want to give the impression that all Samaritans came to Jesus. We see other places where Jesus is speaking to Samaritans and they do not heed what he has to say. But the people of Sychar are an example to all of us. And that's big. So the people who are despised by the Jews become a people who are approved by God because of what? Because of faith. Faith, exactly right. So now look at Paul's writings, for instance, in Romans chapter 4 or in Galatians chapter 4, when he talks about those who are Abraham's children. Now the Jews prided themselves on being Abraham's children, and they wanted to reap all the benefits of that. But who does Paul say there are Abraham's children? Those who come through faith. Faith makes you Abraham's child, not blood. Okay, so we've kind of finished that story. We'll pick up there next time. We'll talk about the official son and then jump into John chapter 5. Mary. Psalm 136, verses 5 and 6 was that reference. Thank you so much.